You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
I wanna be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I wanna be a producer.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey, it's Ken. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the podcast, and I hope it's pulling back the curtain on this business of Broadway. If you're looking to learn more about what makes this industry tick, go to my website, kendavenport.com, and sign up for my weekly newsletter. I'll send you one email a week, one article about what I'm seeing, trends, insights, marketing ideas on what's happening on Broadway right now. That's kendavenport.com. Hope to see you there and in your inbox.
Hello, everybody. This is Ken Davenport, and this is the Producer's Perspective podcast. I am so honored to have on the program today the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Lindsay-Abaire. Welcome, David.
Thank you for having me.
So David took home that big P award for his terrific play, Rabbit Hole. He's also the author of Wonder of the World, Fuddy Mears, Kimberly Akimbo, and the book and lyrics to Shrek, a bunch of films, lots of different stuff, but let's get into it.
Great.
When did you decide you wanted to be a writer?
Well, I had been a writer for a long time before I decided to be one, I think. So it's sort of a complicated question. The very first play that I actually wrote was in fifth grade, and it was a mashup of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves and a Christmas special. Everybody had to submit some kind of Christmas play. It was, you know, probably 6 minutes long. And mine was chosen. So that was really the first play. But I didn't know I would be a playwright. And then later, I did a lot of acting in high school and middle school. And in the school that I went to, every ninth grade does a ninth grade play. And our ninth grade play was History of the American Film, which is this insane musical by Christopher Durang. And so we didn't. We had a great, fun time doing it. And after that, you're dumped into the rest of the high school. But someone said, we should do a 10th grade play. And because you're the funny one, you should write it. And so I wrote a play in 10th grade. And then we did it again in 11th grade. And I wrote a musical with a friend in 12th grade, all through high school, still not knowing that I would be a playwright. And then I went to college at Sarah Lawrence and still thinking I would be an actor, actually, because I did so much acting in high school. And as part of my theater program at Sarah Lawrence, I took a bunch of playwriting classes and wrote a bunch of plays there and produced a couple plays there. Got out of college, got a job at Dance Theater Workshop, worked there for several years, and kept writing plays and submitting my plays. And I applied to the Juilliard program. And it wasn't until I got into the Juilliard playwriting program that I thought, oh, maybe this playwriting thing is working out, and this is something I should pursue. But I was in denial about it for a long time, even though I was writing plays.
Did you go to Sarah Lawrence to be an actor? Were you an acting major?
I wasn't. I mean, it's Sarah Lawrence is sort of a weird place. It actually doesn't have majors. It has concentrations. And so I thought I would, also you can't take that many classes. So I wasn't in the theater department at all my freshman year, although I was in several plays. I was mostly a literature concentration with some psychology and then did some theater on the side. So I thought I might be an English teacher. So no, I didn't think that I would be an act. If I was going to be involved in the theater, I thought I would be an actor more than a writer. And then, as I say, the writing just seemed so much easier and came more naturally to me.
Do you still have those plays you wrote in high school?
I do. They're in a crate somewhere.
When was the last time you read one?
It's been a very, very long time. I can't remember how long. I certainly know how awful they were. But
yeah, that was my question. Are they good?
No, they're abysmal. No, they're terrible. And they were essentially ripoffs of other plays that I loved and adored and was sort of emulating. I was ripping off. I mean, the first play in particular I remember that I wrote in 10th grade was just a ripoff of Tina Howe's Museum, which is this crazy absurdist play where people came and went into a museum and then, you know, they would stay for 8 minutes and then they would leave. And so I wanted to write a play for, you know, 40, 16-year-olds. And so I set it in a restaurant instead, and people would come in and spend 6 minutes, and then they would leave, just like in a museum. And it was ridiculous.
So what do you think, obviously I assume you got better as you wrote more.
One hopes.
And what do you think, look, it's Juilliard, for God's sakes, mm-hmm. right? One of the most prestigious institutions on the planet. What did they see in you that said, this guy is going to win a Pulitzer one day. Let's get him in our program with the, 12 other people that we actually accept every year.
Right. Well, they only let in 4 or 5, actually. And I know that now because I co-run the program, actually. You'll have to ask Marsha Norman, who runs the program, and Chris Durang, who ran it at the time as well. I mean, what we say to writers, and I think it's what they said then, is we pick writers who have a singular voice that pops off the page, that you know that they're doing something that is unique and their own, and they know what their quote unquote stuff is. And so I hope that's what they saw in me, that, I mean, even now I go through piles of scripts for Juilliard, and you know within 3 minutes whether someone has a voice or not, honestly.
About 3 minutes, so just in the first few pages.
Honestly, yeah, if I'm being honest. And I'll read the entire play, and often I'm surprised in the second act and something will jump out at me, but, you know, more often than not, you know immediately whether you're in good hands or not.
So can you describe, just for everyone listening, or try to describe what a voice is? Because I know it when I read it.
Yeah.
I read your stuff, when I read anyone, oh, that person has a voice. But how would you describe it to a writer out there? Like, you got to have a voice. What the F does that mean?
Well, the weird thing is you can't actually teach it to someone, I don't think. People either have an ear or they don't. There's just a specificity to it and an energy to it that, as I say, you can't really teach it. And a point of view often too. I mean, technically, it's often, this isn't true of all plays, but often I want to know why have we gathered here today as an audience or as a reader? What is this play about? What does the main character want? Just really basic stuff. Not that everybody's writing Aristotelian kind of scripts, but if they're trying to, then you want that to be there. And if they're writing something more avant-garde or deconstructionist, then you want something that you haven't seen before, which is really difficult to pull off.
Okay, so you go to Juilliard.
Yes.
And then you graduate, you're just, you know, all of a sudden people are writing big checks to you, and it's so easy to
if
be a writer
only that
or a playwright.
If
right?
only. I will say that I was very lucky right after Juilliard, but, you know, what we're skipping is the fact that I had a full-time job after Sarah Lawrence before I went to Juilliard. So there were many years in the middle where I was working at Dance Theater Workshop as an associate producer, going to see other people's works, mostly avant-garde dance/theater pieces. Juilliard was flexible enough that I could keep my full-time job and pay my rent and still attend Juilliard. And so I wrote a play that I wrote Footing Years there, which was one of my very first plays. And, it was first produced at Juilliard. And, there's sort of a long story about how it got to Manhattan Theater Club, but that was essentially my first play out of Juilliard. And, very luckily it did well at Manhattan Theater Club. And so, that's not most people's journey. I realize how lucky I was. And I think it wasn't that long ago, but I do think that people were taking more risks on emerging and younger playwrights. And so I made in that little window where you could get in without having any kind of track record, which I did not have.
And where did you get the idea for Footing Years? / where do you get your ideas in general?
Generally, most of my plays are written. I have 11, 12, 13 ideas floating around in my head at the same time. And usually the way my plays come about is I take 2 or 3 or 4 ideas and smash them together, the ones that don't go away, that are very persistent. And so for Footing Years specifically, I had seen a news report about a woman, actually I think it was about a man, I made it a woman, but it was about a man with a very rare case of amnesia where he would go to sleep every night and forget everything and start all over every morning, that he could retain information in the course of the day. And then forget it as soon as he fell asleep. And I thought that was so bizarre and interesting and theatrical. And then I thought, oh, I know the first and the last scenes of that play. I change into a woman, but it's going to be this woman waking up and someone saying, I'm your husband and that's your son. And here's a book of how the appliances work. And you have this strange amnesia. Good luck. And I knew that the very last scene of the play would be that same woman with her family desperately trying to keep her awake so that they wouldn't lose her. And it's sort of a death that must happen at the end of every day for those families. And then the way the play was written, I wrote it at Juilliard in 10-page increments. So I would just bring in 10 pages every week to class. And if you look at that play, there's either a cliffhanger or a little aha moment at the end of every 10 pages because I was amusing my fellow students at Juilliard. That's rarely, I don't write plays like that anymore. I write them in very different ways, but that's how that happened.
And how do you write them now? How is that changing?
I mean, I've become much, for better or for worse, I've become, much more structured. Maybe structured isn't the right word, although I think they are much more structured. I really think about what it is that I'm writing in a way and how it's built and thematically, what am I writing about and what does my protagonist want? These basic questions that I should have been asking, but was too willful to ask those questions early on. It's so much easier if you actually know what you're doing and you have a plan, but you're also loose enough to let go of that plan, whatever it might be, and follow impulses that might veer away from what you thought you were writing about. And so, you know, I've been doing this long enough that I can do both of those things, have a structure in the back of my head while also being free enough to go where the play wants to go.
Do you do a lot of research? Are you a research person?
It depends on the play. I mean, for Rabbit Hole, which was a very different kind of play, which is about a family grieving the death of a child, I felt a responsibility to make sure that I got that right. And so I had my own experiences with grief. I had never lost a child. I'm thankful to say, but I had a child, and you know the reason that play was written was because of my fear of losing that child. But then I read a lot of books about grief and losing children specifically, and realized that I was going to look at that situation from a bunch of different points of view. And so I did a lot of research for that, and then not so much for Good People, which was a play that came after Rabbit Hole, which was very much about my hometown and which was set in South Boston, which was about class and race in Boston. And so I just knew it so intimately that I didn't really have to crack a book about it because I knew those people very well.
Being from Massachusetts myself, a fellow Massel, I love that piece.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.
So let's talk about Rabbit Hole and just the perception you have when you finish something. So you finished Rabbit Hole.
Mm-hmm.
Did you say, this is good? This is going to get some attention. Can you tell on your stuff?
No, not in any way, especially with that piece, because that I had never written a play like it. All my plays before that were like Fuddy Mears and Kimberly Akimbo and Wonder of the World. They were absurdist, just crazy, insane plays. And the reason Rabbit Hole got written, I mean, there were a bunch of reasons, but one of them was, you know, I was very lucky critically with those absurdist plays. At the same time, there were some critics that just hated those plays. I never got a middling review for those plays. Either someone loved Fuddy Mears or they despised it with an unbridled passion. And so I would read these same critics that hated those plays, and I should not have read those critics, but I did. And they would write very differently about naturalistic plays. My absurdist plays, they would just dismiss as ridiculousness and people don't behave this way. Why are we watching this? And whether a realistic or naturalistic play was good or bad, they would approach it different critically. I felt that they would dig in and at least try to examine thematically what a writer was trying to do. And so I grumpily thought, I could write a naturalistic play if I wanted to. I mean, what do you get a couch and some running water and that's it, right? And so that was one of the 11 things that were floating around in my head. One day I will write a naturalistic play to spite those people. And then another thing that was floating around in my head was when I was a student at Juilliard, Marcia had said to us once, if you want to write a good play, write about the thing that terrifies you the most. And when I was a student at Juilliard, I didn't know what that was. But when I had a child, as I mentioned earlier, having a child puts a fear in you that is unlike anything that you've ever experienced. And so I thought, oh, wait, here's my greatest fear that Marcia mentioned. Maybe I'll make this a naturalistic play just as an experiment and see what happens. And so that's what I did. And no, I did not think, oh, this will win all the prizes and this will change everything. Quite the contrary. I thought, what the hell have I done? I have no business writing a naturalistic play. No one is going to like it. And confirming those fears, I submitted it to the theater that commissioned the play, which will go nameless right now. But they didn't like it. they thought, oh, they said, oh, we thought we were going to get another comedy from him. And there was some confusion. They thought I was handing in an old play. And so the initial response was not good to the play. So I thought, oh, I've made a terrible mistake. I had no business writing this kind of play. What was I thinking? And then it got to Manhattan Theater Club, and Dan Sullivan wanted to direct it, and Cynthia Nixon signed up, and MTC said, let's, you know, try it at the Biltmore, which is now the Friedman, but it's their Broadway space. And luckily it did very well, but it took a long time for me to get over the hump of feeling like, okay, I didn't do bad.
When you write now, after all your success, and finish a play, do you still have moments of like, oh, this is not good enough, this is a, someone's going to find me out?
Oh, more than moments. I mean, I spend most of my day thinking that. And, you know, I say that not out of humility, but out of genuine insecurity. I also feel like the best thing I can say about myself as a writer is that I constantly think of myself as a student, that I constantly think of myself as that guy sitting in the room at Juilliard listening to Marsha Norman and Chris Durang give us advice. And so I'm always reading plays and attending plays and thinking, how does this work? How is it built? Why doesn't it work? Why does it work? And so when I approach a play, whether I'm in the middle of it or at the beginning, I think, how do I build this? What's the best way to do it? And am I doing it correctly? And very luckily, I'm in a writer's group and have been for almost 20 years. After we graduated from Juilliard, a bunch of us said, well, now what do we do? And someone, my friend Daniel Goldfarb, came up with the idea of like, let's just do what we did at Juilliard, but we'll do it in my living room without Chris and Marsha, and we'll gather every 2 weeks, and we'll just keep bringing in our plays and sharing with each other. And that's what we have done and continue to do. And
Still, so this is
met last week. Yeah. And I'll bring in a new play next week to them. And, that's how my plays get written, because these are a group of people who I trust, we speak the same language, and we've been together for so long, and the writers have come and gone a little bit, but a lot of us are still the same writers that were there from the beginning. And they just respond to the work in a very supportive but constructive way.
I'm obsessed with this because I'm a huge fan of masterminds and a huge fan of these writers groups. The book Creativity Inc. talks about a brain trust.
Yep.
People and peers being the best people to give you feedback. Forget focus groups, forget audiences even. Your peers are the best. But how many people in this group?
10.
And look, you've had some serious success, and I know Daniel very well, and he's had success. But how do you keep the competition out of a group like that? How do you keep the, like, you know, look, you've got some big awards on your mantle, other people may not. How does that...
Well, the fact that you keep coming back, I think, is a testament to the humility in the group that, you know, I have a good year this year, and someone else will have a good year 2 years, and then someone goes dry for a few years. Like, that's part of the business. If you're going to be a writer, if you're lucky enough to have a career, then it's going to be good for some people. It's going to be bad at times. And that's just what is, and we're not in there comparing resumes. We're just in there trying to help each other write plays.
What I love about, so you obviously do read reviews.
I do, yeah.
Yeah, still to this day.
Yeah, every one of them.
How you describe reading them, though, is you really analyze it from a business perspective. Like what, and I have this big theory that the most successful artists are actually really incredible business people deep down.
Uh-huh.
They just may not realize it, and it sounds like you're one of those. Because you really were like, what do they want?
Right.
And you tried to find and create something that they wanted, which worked.
Right. That sounds very cynical when you say it like that.
And I know, obviously, it didn't come because, you know, Marsha's comments.
Right. Well, that's the thing. If I only wrote from a place of cynicism, that it was, I'm going to give them exactly what they want, it's going to check all these boxes, and it will be this type of couple with that couch and the running water that I mentioned, then it wouldn't have been a good play, I don't think. I had to find the thing that resonated with me emotionally and that I could build a story around. Otherwise, it would have just fallen flat. And, you know, and the lesson was actually, if we're getting down to it, you know, there were critics that loved my earlier plays that loved Rabbit Hole. And there are critics that hated my earlier plays that hated Rabbit Hole. And then I converted some people. Some people were like, oh, David Lindsay-Abaire has finally grown up and written a mature, artful piece. And there were just as many people that said, what a sellout. I love the mayhem of those crazy comedies, and now he's writing a play about this bourgeoisie couple with a couch and running water. And so critically, it was actually a complete wash. But more importantly, it gave me a toolbox that I had never used before. you know, that early on I was sort of dismissive of naturalistic plays and thought, oh, no, no, I want to do something crazy and off the wall. Joe Wharton and Christopher Durang and my heroes, Tina Howe. And now, or I could write a play like, you know, Marcia Norman or, you know, The Naturalist. Marcia doesn't always write naturalistic plays, but, and so when I got to Good People, because I had the success of Rabbit Hole, I felt empowered to write in whatever way I wanted to. That play, I didn't want to be dismissed as an absurdist comedy, so I thought I should write a naturalistic version of these people that I know and care about. And I wouldn't have been able to do that if I hadn't written Rabbit Hole. And maybe not if Rabbit Hole hadn't been embraced.
You've written a couple musicals.
I have, yeah.
Do you enjoy the musical process?
Do I enjoy the musical process? It's such a complicated question. when it's just the work, I absolutely love it. That part is fantastic. I worked on the best parts are the collaborations, honestly. And they were two very different musicals, and my experiences were very different on them. High Fidelity was amazing because of Amanda Green and Tom Kitt, and I loved them desperately as people, and I loved working with them. And in that situation, I was only the book writer. I was not the lyricist. And that show, sadly, did not go as we had all hoped it would. And so that was eye-opening for a bunch of different reasons. I mean, talk about analyzing. All we still, whenever we get together, three of us, why didn't it work? What went wrong? And every time we meet, it's a different reason. And it's probably a combination of eight different things of why that show wasn't embraced. And then I did Shrek the Musical, which was a totally different animal. And I mean, like High Fidelity, although High Fidelity had a book first, it was based on a movie that was incredibly popular. And it was being produced by a major Hollywood studio. And so we were treated differently because the folks that run DreamWorks, God bless them, were used to dealing with writers in a very specific way, which is we will tell you to do something and you will do it. And Janine Tesori and I were theater artists that were used to being in charge of our own work. And so that was really difficult. That said, working with Janine was an amazing thing. I love everything about her. And after Shrek, and there are great things about Shrek, and there are things that annoy me about Shrek. And happily it's produced in every high school in America now. So that's a good thing. And it changed a lot after Broadway. I mean, that's the other thing about musicals is they take so long to write. And even after Broadway, it wasn't finished. We then went back and rewrote it for, the West End, and we rewrote it for the tour. And now it's a much sharper, better show than it was when it was on Broadway. So there's that. You usually don't have the chance to revisit plays in that way. But afterwards, I said to Janine, oh, that was really hard. And I loved working with you. Can we write a musical in the same way that I write a play, where nobody else is involved, nobody knows about it, we start from scratch, it's not based on a movie, and no one will, it could be awful for a long time until we figure it out. And then when we're ready, then we'll show it to people. And so Janine and I have just finished the first draft of a brand new musical that nobody knows about. And it's been joy from beginning to end in a way that those other musicals were joyful at times, but certainly not from beginning to end.
Yeah, you know, as we get more and more corporate here and we have these giant brands coming to Broadway that are put on schedules, announced, booked into theaters, out of towns, etc., before drafts are even completed,
right,
you end up with mediocre products.
Right.
They're not driven by the artist as the theater as it should be.
Exactly right. And you take any scene or any song or any event in a play or a musical, you don't know what it is for a while. You need to do it and figure it out and realize, oh, here's what's wrong with it. Let's tweak it in this way and diagnose it and figure it out and sometimes throw the song away or sometimes adjust the song. My experience with Shrek, at least, is if it wasn't there at the beginning, then it was dismissed and we had to start over. And Janine and I have, and this is not an exaggeration, 50 songs that didn't make it into the musical because it just wasn't there the first draft. And so the people in charge said, no, that's not it, guys. Try again. As opposed to like, well, it might be it. Why isn't it? Let's really examine it. And they were wonderful in lots of ways. So I don't mean to dismiss them as the producers. They were wonderful in lots of ways, but the theatrical process was not something that they were accustomed to,
well,
it seemed.
Listen, I will say it is that producing a movie is not producing a musical. It's just a very different thing.
Correct.
Had you written lyrics before? And what was that process like for you?
I had not written lyrics before. I had done a composer librettist workshop at New Dramatist, and so I had written songs before, but not many. And I love the process. I was about to say the hard part of High Fidelity wasn't a hard part. It was it's just a different process. Is not being the lyric writer, I would write book scenes that led up to a wonderful song, or I would write a book scene that would then get pillaged and turned into a song. And so that's just the baggage of being a book writer in a musical, where you hand over the best part of the show to the lyricist and composer. And generally what happens is, in a song, that's where the dramatic event happens, in a scene, right? And as a dramatist, like, I want to write the dramatic event. I want to get to the meat of it and not just tee everyone else up and wave from the sidelines while they have fun. And so it was Janine's idea that I write the lyrics for Shrek. She had worked with several other playwrights who had never written lyrics before, so that's her gig. She loves doing that. And I was a little insecure about it. And I said, well, let's just write a couple songs to see if I can even do it. And we did. We wrote two songs, and they're in the show still. Of the 50 that were cut, those two were not in the bunch. And I loved it.
I often think of book writers as the setter on a volleyball team. They just set it up and let the others spike it.
It's tricky. I mean, you're also just in charge of the architecture of the whole thing, but nobody knows that. Most people just think, well, you wrote the words in between the songs. It's like, no, we did a lot more. The whole shape of it is ours. And the other thing, too, is I've always been obsessed with word puzzles and, Scrabbles and palindromes and any word stuff. So the lyric writing was just sort of an extension of that fun playing with word stuff.
When you're writing plays, do you like directors to come on board early or late?
Late. Because I want to know what it is before someone else is invited to the party. I mean, I have my writer's group to help dramaturgically if I need that, and so I don't need guidance from a director. And also, when a director comes new to a show that I think is finished, they always enlighten me in ways that I find surprising and exciting. And if they're in it early in the process, then their hands are dirty and they're not as, they're as unclean as I am. They don't have fresh eyes. And so it's better that I hand over a script and say, I think this is finished. What do you think? And they say, yes, yes, yes. Here's a confusing moment. And actors can do that too, especially because they're breathing in the characters and they're living it. And they say, I understand this. I don't know how I get to that moment. And sometimes the answer is, it's there, you'll get it. And sometimes the answer is, I'll see you tomorrow with some new pages. And that's just great collaboration.
So on something like Rabbit Hole, how much did Cynthia or the actors in general influence that final script?
It's funny. Rabbit Hole, more than any of my scripts, was the most complete. I certainly made discoveries in the play that I didn't know were there, but there wasn't so much rewriting, actually. It was more them turning up knobs and just highlighting stuff that maybe I thought was underneath a little bit. So there wasn't a lot of rewriting. It was more illuminating stuff that was there, whether I knew it or not.
You've written for the other mediums, right?
Mm-hmm. Television. Film, not television. Do I enjoy film? The first couple drafts of films I always enjoy. That part is great when they hire you and say, we love you and we love all your ideas and go write this script.
Here's money.
I mean, that is, that, you know, it's nice to get paid and, pay your mortgage. That stuff is fun. But almost always, for me at least, you get two or three drafts in and everybody suddenly realizes, oh, you know, it would be better. And it's never better. It's always worse. And it gets put, there's so many people involved and their concerns are seldom storytelling. They might say they are, but everybody has a hand in it and they're wrecking it. And, I'm very deliberate about writing scenes with specific moments. It's there for a reason. This moment is an event that gets us to the next scene. And, not a lot of movie people understand the architecture of stories. Some do, and those people are great to work with. More often than not, that's not their concern. They're like, oh, I like this line, and this is great, and what a great character. And then it gets changed, and the events and the reasons are often washed away, and that's why so many movies are so terrible.
So obviously you have had successes, you've had some shows that have not worked. Obviously, High Fidelity, and I'm one of those super fan of that show. Tom Kidd has been on this podcast.
Oh, my best buddy, Tom.
That show should have run a lot longer than it did. When a show doesn't work like that,
yeah,
how do you pick yourself up and get back in front of the computer and go at it again? Were you hurt when that show specifically, or any show doesn't work?
Yeah, of course. You're devastated. I mean, it's a little different with a musical because you share the burden of it. And so it's not, you know, excised from your heart whole cloth. I'm mixing metaphors here, but because it's not entirely yours, for me at least, it hurt a little bit less, and I could share the pain of it with Tom and Amanda and get on the phone and lament what happened. And so it certainly hurt really badly. and I mean, more than hurt, it was more confusing. You know, that's the weird thing is like, well, why did it happen and what did we do wrong? And it's because of the marketing, right? You never blame yourself. No one says this was just a bad idea, which might be the case. We still haven't gotten to that yet. But the important thing is to just keep working. I mean, I think I've been in a position where by the time reviews have come out for any of my shows, I'm already on to the next project. And so, again, if you're lucky enough to have a career, that's just going to happen. I don't know anyone who's only had giant hits. I can't name a single person. And so you lick your wound and say, oh, this is one of the bumps. And hopefully the next one won't be. And that's all you can do.
As you said at the beginning, you're running the Juilliard program. What's the biggest mistake that you see new writers make?
Well, it's hard to specify. I guess the biggest mistake for me is reason. Why am I reading this play? Why is this an interesting story? Why should I care? And so sometimes that's just about clarity of purpose. Again, what does the main character want? And is what they want engaging and stage worthy? Often it's not. I mean, I'll read really brilliant dialogue that will go on for 20 pages and the dialogue could be hilarious and great banter. And if you're on page 20 and nothing has happened yet and no one wants anything yet, no matter how brilliant the dialogue is, I'm putting it aside. There's nothing happening in this play. And so that's the main advice. And I give it to myself every morning. What is happening in the scene? And what's going to happen when the scene is over? What is the event that's going to propel me to the next scene? And if I can't answer that question, then I'm in trouble. And once I can answer it, then the writing becomes so much easier. Oh, great. He has to find out this information from this woman, and she's not going to give him what he wants. Okay, great. She didn't do it. Now what's he going to do? We go on to scene two. I mean, it sounds really basic and simple, and not all plays are that way or built that way, but most of the ones that we see are. And so my answer would be different if you're not writing that kind of play.
Do you write every single day for a specific period of time? Are you like an office hours type guy?
I am. I'm an office hours guy. So I start generally at 9:30 every day. The kids are at school, and I start at 9:30, and I end at 6.
9:30 to 6.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of that is goofing off on Facebook and procrastinating, and but often because I'm juggling several things at once, I'm writing a play, I'm writing a musical, I'm writing a movie. The deadline is really cracking the whip for me, and so I have no choice. This thing is due in 12 weeks, and I have to make sure that I chip away at it every single day. And a play usually doesn't come with a deadline, and so if I'm chipping away at that movie deadline, I better make sure that I get in, you know, 2 hours of playwriting. Otherwise, that play will never get written.
Any tips for getting through writer's block?
I don't often get writer's block. I get writer stuck, which is that thing about getting in the scene and wondering what the hell I'm doing there. It's just it's asking those basic questions about what is this play about? And why did I care enough about this story to write it? And going back to whatever that answer was.
Okay, my last question, which is my genie question. I want you to imagine the genie from Aladdin comes to visit you.
All right.
And wants to thank you for your contributions to the American theater by granting you one wish. What's the one thing that drives you crazy about Broadway that makes you mad? You're such a nice guy. You know, what makes you would want you to flip this table up and bang on it and would you'd ask this genie to wish away?
Wish away. Can I wish for something? I'm going to wish for something. And, all right. Well, it's only because I've been seeing Tony season is marathon-y this year, right? And so I just saw Iceman Cometh last night. 4 solid hours. God bless it. I was there for every minute of it. I'm seeing Harry Potter next week, taking up an entire Wednesday. And the following Wednesday, I'm seeing Angels in America. And so these marathons are in my head. If I could wish for anything, I wish that every producer that produced a play on Broadway had to produce a play by an emerging writer that was a little less conventional. than that big splashy movie to musical or the great wonderful revival they might be producing. That was a requirement to producing on Broadway. And everyone that bought a ticket to the Broadway show would have to go see that play as well. The play by Madhuri Shaker or Danye Love or these wonderful younger writers that are coming up. And so at 5 o'clock, you see this wonderful adventurous play by a new writer and you're thrilled by it. And then you go on dinner and then you go see the big splashy musical. That's my wish.
That's a very interesting subscription model. I love it. First of all, it's like a prerequisite to be able to produce a big Hollywood quote-unquote hit and then have an audience to see them. I love it.
Well, we want to build our audiences. That's the only way to do it, is get them in there, force them sometimes.
And build our new writers and young writers.
Exactly right.
Thank you for that. Thank you for joining us today. Thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you next time.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
It's time for today's Lucky Land Horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.